After 8 years, the Attorney General says there may be a trial of the new century for the 9/11 mastermind and his accomplices.
They will be brought to New York to answer for their alleged crimes in a courthouse just blocks away from where the Twin Towers once stood.
At the Hall of Justice in Nuremberg, history's greatest trial nears its fateful close. Under the most elaborate security precautions, only official cars pass the heavily guarded street barricade.
So if there is a Nuremberg-like trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in federal court in Lower Manhattan, would you be someone watching the proceedings, retired New York firefighter Lee Ielpe?
No, I don't think so.
Now, why?
Well, I think the Attorney General has not thought this through at all. I feel that this is going to make a mockery of our judicial system. Having it in the United States, let alone New York City, is totally irresponsible in my eyes.
Now, you say Attorney General Holder hasn't thought this through, but you've been thinking about this since the day of 9/11, right?
Yes, I lost my son, Jonathan, 29 years old, married, New York City firefighter, doing what he loved to do. For me, and I think for the people of this city, the people of this country, this is going to reopen wounds of 8 years ago, not just for the family members, but for the hundreds of thousands of people who were affected that day, from people who left co-workers behind,
right,
people who lived and worked in the area.
Well, Lee, what do you say to this argument? Some say that the biggest triumph against the terrorists would be a trial in open criminal court in New York City, right near where the Twin Towers fell, that would be the best way to fight this idea that terrorism can affect our way of life.
No, I don't think so. I think bringing it back to the states and using our judicial system, which is the best in the world, but in this circumstance, these are terrorists and they should be treated as such. And I think Guantanamo has enough transparency, and a military trial is the only way to handle these animals.
All right. Thank you, Lee Ielpe, a retired New York City firefighter who lost his 29-year-old son, Jonathan, on 9/11 in the attacks of September 11th. More on the search for justice and peace on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Tough questions. We're going to get some answers. Good morning. It's Monday, November 16th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. So are the Colts the team of destiny? The New England Patriots seem to think so. The difficult dynamics in the home when kids come back to stay. And how long can the Republicans keep the health care bill stalled? Also, have you cleared out the cobwebs in your wallet? The numbers say you might be spending more than you did over the summer. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
President Obama now meeting with President Hu Jintao of China in Beijing. Trade and economic issues expected to dominate the conversation. Earlier this morning, the president spoke to students in Shanghai during a town hall-style meeting where he spoke of a new openness.
These freedoms of expression and worship, of access to information and political participation, we believe are universal rights.
The president suggested the Chinese government should stop censoring the internet. Here at home, as we've been talking about, the plan to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in New York City is drawing a lot of disagreement. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, blasted the idea on Fox News.
He's asking for a trial in New York, and we're giving it to him. Since when are we in the business of granting the wishes of terrorists?
And Senator Pat Leahy told CBS's Face the Nation,
if somebody murders Americans and they murder Americans in America, they ought to be prosecuted in America.
The legal implications of all that coming right up.
Looking like the Dow is going to open at 10,270. The S&P will start trade at 1093. And the NASDAQ is going to open up at 2168. Dow futures are up 65 points.
We're asking you to react to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's trial here in Lower Manhattan. What do you think? Should he go to civilian court or military?
I think the question comes down to, what do you consider terrorism, an act of war or a crime? It's an act of war, and we should prosecute it accordingly. And I think the military tribunal is the best venue for that.
We'll talk to two guests about that in just a moment, but give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
After 8 years of delay, those allegedly responsible for the attacks of September the 11th will finally face justice. They will be brought to New York, to to answer for their alleged crimes in a courthouse just blocks away from where the Twin Towers once stood.
The announcement from U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder on Friday, saying that the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center will be closed, as President Obama promised during his campaign, and to render some legitimate judgment on the detainees being held there, as the U.S. Supreme Court has demanded. The man who calls himself the mastermind of the 9/11 terror attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, along with some accomplices, will be brought to federal court to face trial. What do New Yorkers think?
We want to give them the same kind of constitutional protections as the guy who was arrested here on Bleecker Street for dealing drugs. You want to give him that? I don't think so.
They should be here. They should be in New York, where the event occurred, and allow the citizens of New York to witness firsthand the administration of justice.
Certainly, the implications of a trial in Lower Manhattan of these suspects was on everyone's mind in New York over this weekend. Another set of suspected terrorists, we should remind you, currently detained at Guantanamo Bay, will be tried in military prisons. That announcement from Attorney General Holder on Friday. And joining us now to discuss these apparent two tracks of legal accountability for the Gitmo detainees are Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate. Good morning, Dahlia.
Good morning.
And Jonathan Hafis is director of the National Security Project at the ACLU. Jonathan, good morning. Dahlia, let's and both of you jump in, but how much of this, Dahlia Lithwick, is the Obama administration's particular style of dealing with the detainees, and how much of this is explicitly dictated by numerous Supreme Court rulings on what's going on down there?
This is, I think, very typical for the Obama administration. This is how they tend to problem solve. They've thought about this for going on a year now, and they're trying very, very hard to accommodate all the constituencies. I think they've made it very clear right from the beginning that the military tribunals weren't going to be quite enough. Then they had to really problem solve how are we going to bring these people stateside with massive public resistance. And they, I think, tried to cobble together a solution that in some sense gives a little bit of something to everybody, in some sense makes everybody very frustrated. But I think that the cornerstone piece of it, that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is going to be tried in an open trial in a federal court, is emblematic of this Obama administration's attempt to try to fix and repair the worst excesses of the Guantanamo years, while still hopefully making sure that they have people who are not going to be let walk free on the street when it's over.
Well, the question of a possible acquittal, that sort of looms in the background. We'll talk about that in a moment. But Jonathan Hafis, what about the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed case particularly would qualify it for federal criminal court versus the other cases that were mentioned?
Well, I think this is a very important step that they're going to be trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in a federal court in New York. This demonstrates a faith in the federal criminal justice system to handle terrorism cases. This is where terrorism cases have always been brought, and this is where they should be brought. It's a way to mete out justice consistent with our constitutional values and our history.
And if Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded more than 180 times, how much of his so-called confessional evidence could be used in open court? And if it's not admissible, then aren't we talking about classified documents and it's really a circus at that point?
Well, no evidence that's obtained through torture tactics such as waterboarding can be admitted in any federal court or in any court of any civilized nation that seeks to stand by basic values. That doesn't mean that there is not other evidence that was not obtained through other methods. But any trial that's going to be fair and recognized as anything else but a sham in the eyes of the world cannot use evidence that's derived from the modern equivalent of the rack and the screw.
So, Dahlia Lithwick, what are the alternatives then, and how does this case not become a complete reopening of the entire pre-9/11 espionage picture where what did they know and when did they know it kind of thing?
I think we have to credit the Attorney General. If he thought this was going to be a circus trial or a frame-up based on torture evidence, they wouldn't have brought these charges. They certainly would have brought them in New York. Holder was very careful to say in his statement, he has other evidence that we haven't seen before. One other thing that's worth noting is that in December, in front of his military tribunal, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed said, I want to plead guilty. So I think the assumption we're going to have a three-year circus trial is a little premature. I think this man wants to be martyred. I'm not sure that that we're even going to get to the point where we're talking about admitting torture evidence or top secret evidence. But I really do think we should take the Justice Department at their at faith when they say they have a very, very strong case against KSM that is not predicated on torture evidence or evidence that's going to jeopardize national security.
Jonathan Hafitz, do you think a guilty plea by KSM pretty much puts the circus trial off limits?
Well, I don't think it would be a circus trial even if KSM or the other defendants were to plead not guilty. There's an incredibly capable group of judges in the district court in New York who would handle this. It's one of the most, if not the most sophisticated prosecutor's office and defense bar, and I think this case will be handled whether he pleads guilty or not. Now, certainly if he pleads guilty, it will be a much shorter proceeding, but there's also, of course, the sentencing phase. But no matter what, the federal courts are more than capable of handling it and have been able to successfully handle so many terrorism cases, even in the last 7 years, while the military commission system, by contrast, has been an utter and complete failure.
You know, you were talking earlier about how this expresses a faith in the justice system, and this would be a question for you, Jonathan, is that many people, as we've been hearing all over the country, don't share that same faith. They feel as though a civilian trial has so much wiggle room in it that there's going to be some way for the defense attorneys to argue or procedural matters or again, the waterboarding issue that will allow the defendants to somehow wriggle away.
Well, I think that may be based on a lot of the propaganda of the past 8 years that's really been kind of against our system of justice and our values, maybe a little bit too much television. Defense lawyers, as they always will, be able to make vigorous arguments, but it doesn't mean those arguments will succeed. And, you know, we've had this system around for more than 220 years. It's done us very well, and it was a disaster to abandon it, and it's a good thing to return to it.
Dahlia, very quickly before we go, no death penalty in New York. What's the implication of that? And finally, the military tribunals. So where does that leave the tribunals at this point?
It doesn't matter whether there's a death penalty in New York. They're going to seek the death penalty. This is a federal trial. In terms of the tribunals, it's an enormous problem, as former prosecutor for Guantanamo Mo Davis said presciently a week before, having two different tiers of justice depending on the quality of your evidence against the detainees is highly problematic.
Well, we shall see. All right, Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate, thanks for being with us. Jonathan Hafitz is director of the National Security Project at the ACLU and co-author of the book The Guantanamo Lawyers, Inside a Prison, Outside the Law. And now at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the headlines we're following this morning.
At the start of his first state visit to China, President Obama has said the U.S. and China need not be adversaries and the world would benefit if they cooperated. But in remarks during a debate with young people in Shanghai, he appeared to criticize China's leadership, saying freedom of expression and religious freedom should be available to all. At that town hall-style meeting, the president was also asked a question about diversity in his own family. Here's his answer.
In my own family, I have a father who was from Kenya. I have a mother who was from Kansas in the Midwest of the United States. My sister is half Indonesian. She's married to a Chinese person from Canada.
The president is now in Beijing for talks with China's President Hu Jintao. The trade and other economic issues are expected to dominate the agenda. Our partner, the BBC, has been out in the streets of Beijing looking for a reaction to the president's visit. This woman said the president's welcome in Beijing.
I don't know him very much. I just know he is the president of America, and I think he is okay. Yes, I like him.
Back in the U.S., political disagreement over the decision to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in New York City has continued. Former Mayor Rudy Giuliani says it was, quote, granting the wishes of terrorists, while New York Senator Charles Schumer disagreed and said that the federal court is the best place to resolve these issues. A poll this morning suggests hidden costs have Americans worried about Democratic proposals to overhaul health care, but the Associated Press poll shows a widely shared conviction that major health care changes are needed. NASA is preparing for its next launch. Tons of spare parts are scheduled to be on their way to the International Space Station later today. Space Shuttle Atlantis is expected to blast off with a load of spares this afternoon. Coming up, things may not be rosy in the news business, but how come Bloomberg's figured everything out? Bloomberg News, more about that in a moment.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Some takeouts for you on the news this morning. I'm going to start with business, also a media story. That's why we're turning to the friend of the show, Johnny Roberts. He's a veteran media writer, formerly of Newsweek and the Wall Street Journal. Johnny, so we're hearing so much about the struggles of the newspaper industry, so much about the struggles of other media industries, especially news outlets. And yet we have this news that Bloomberg News, which is a multi-platform news service, they do radio, they do news, they do internet, they do all kinds of stuff, that they're doing great, right? They're thriving.
You noted that other the traditional newspapers and magazines are firing people. Well, actually, Bloomberg is sweeping up many of those reporters who are being tossed out onto the streets from old media. What's going on at Bloomberg is that it's expanding dramatically with the goal of establishing itself sort of as a major force in the media business beyond its traditional or historic core market, Wall Street. The core business of Bloomberg really has been financial data, analytics, and other software that help Wall Street traders make money, analyze risk, and spot opportunities.
And clients pay a pretty penny for that stuff.
That's right. It's about $20,000 a year for the terminal, what they are software packages that are on Wall Street desks all over the place.
Okay. And Bloomberg is less than 20 years old. And I'm wondering, are we talking apples and oranges here to compare, say, Bloomberg to the New York Times or the Los Angeles Times? Are these two totally different things, or are there things that these newspapers, traditional newspapers, can learn from Bloomberg in order to improve their bottom line?
Well, they are different animals, and it's about 30 years old. Next year, I think 30 years old. But yeah, they're very different animals. As I said earlier, Bloomberg has been in the information business, so it has that in common with the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, et cetera. But it focused on very specific financial data and information, and that was a very different revenue source.
Right.
Traditional newspapers and magazines, as you well know, the business there is advertising and subscribers.
Right.
Those are all going away.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. That's Johnny Roberts, a veteran media writer formerly of Newsweek and the Wall Street Journal.
Sports takeout now from sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Couple of things. First of all, the Giants had their best Sunday in weeks because their rivals in the East, the Cowboys and the Eagles, lost, and they didn't play. The Giants didn't play. And the poor Jets quarterback here in New York needs to get another job. He lost one more time. But the huge football story is the undefeated Indianapolis Colts beat the New England Patriots 35-34. Now, Ibrahim, I recall you saying this the other day.
The Colts are starting to feel like a team of destiny.
Whoa. Dude, are they a team of destiny? They're undefeated. That was an amazing game last night.
So the New England Patriots rattled off three straight touchdowns at the end of the second half, and it looked like the Patriots weren't poised to take this game with ease,
right.
And they had quieted the Indianapolis crowd. Come to the second half and really into the fourth quarter, they were up 31-14 to start off the fourth quarter, and the Indianapolis Colts scored 21 points in the fourth quarter, and it all came down to the two minute and 8 seconds left, and it was a fourth and two, and Coach Belichick for the New England Patriots decided to go for it. Besides the fact that he was backed up against, you know, close to his own end zone, and he went for it on fourth and two, and they did not get it, and that was the call of the game, because then Indianapolis had literally 30 yards to go to score a touchdown. They took that 30 yards, they scored the touchdown, and they kicked the go-ahead extra point, and they won by 1 point.
So, you know, this was set up as a duel between quarterbacks Tom Brady and Peyton Manning.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, it was Belichick who got out-coached. That's what this was about.
And it was also, surprisingly, there was some fumbles, there was interceptions. You didn't see Dwight Freeney have the day that I thought he was going to have getting to the quarterback. It was really a game of runs and who was going to make the last run. I really feel like if New England had made the last run, they would have won the game.
So do you want to do a little Angels sort of statement about the Super Bowl? We got the Saints still undefeated. Saints, Colts.
I will say this. Because of the way the Cincinnati Bengals are playing, and they won this weekend as well, 18-12 over Pittsburgh, the AFC picture is looking very, very crowded, which includes Pittsburgh Steelers, the New England right. Patriots, the Indianapolis Colts, and the Cincinnati Bengals. The Bengals are the tough team. But no matter what's going to happen, the road to the Super Bowl has to go through New England still. So whoever's going to have to win is going to have to go through those teams.
All right. And on the national?
The NFC is much more – there's a little bit more parity, but obviously the Saints are at the top of that pile. And I think that they are definitely the team to beat.
Saints at the top. Saints at the top on the national NFC side. All right. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports Contributor. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good morning.
And our last takeout comes from you, our listeners. On Friday, we asked you how the foreclosure crisis was affecting your neighborhood and if you'd seen vacant houses around your home.
My name is Rusty. I'm from Detroit, Michigan, or around about. I don't have so much houses that are abandoned because I live in an apartment complex. What I've noticed is actually people are almost beating down the doors to get into apartment complexes. Maybe it's because they're cheaper.
But Molly, also in Detroit, sees no boom on her block. She writes, I have 7 houses standing on my block and 1 empty lot. 4 houses are occupied. That's led to my car being stolen at gunpoint once and a second attempt to steal it by hotwiring it. My isolated block is a haven for crime. That's how the housing crisis is affecting me.
Teresa from Oklahoma writes that everything's okay in her neighborhood. She writes, we don't have any foreclosures. Every house in my cul-de-sac is inhabited. We had one rental property which sold in October to someone who will occupy his home and not rent it out. But Lisa in Monmouth County, New Jersey writes that the single foreclosed dwelling on her block is already a spook house. The home down the street is under foreclosure. The family has stayed in the home and on the property for the past year, but they're no longer invested in the property, so the front and backyard has become a dumping ground for equipment, waste, and debris. The home has slowly become the neighborhood mess. Tell us how the foreclosure crisis is affecting you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're also talking about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Can the self-proclaimed 9/11 mastermind head to New York and get a fair trial? Does it matter? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, there's a lot of news to keep track of this week, and we're going to try and help you get a handle on it all with the agenda coming up in a few moments. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. President Obama is meeting Chinese President Hu Jintao in Beijing this morning for a conversation expected to be dominated by trade and economic issues. Earlier, President Obama nudged China to ease its restrictions on the internet. Here at home, General Motors says it lost $1.2 billion from the time it left bankruptcy protection through the end of September. That is far better than the $10 billion that GM burned through in the first quarter. This comes hours after the company said it will start repaying its debt to the government sooner than expected.
The Atlantis space shuttle will be more like a pickup truck this afternoon. It's lugging up nearly 15 tons of spare parts to the International Space Station. That's assuming the launch gets underway. It's scheduled for 2:30 today. And here's a story out of Germany we found pretty amusing this morning, kind of an animal story. Cops say there were some thieves who stole a circus van. I hate that when that happens. And as they were making their getaway, they noticed what was asleep in the back. It was a full-grown male lion. The thieves abandoned the van after crashing it into a sign from some startlement, I gather. But the lion was not hurt. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective.
It's Monday. That means it's time to check out what's on the agenda. There is a lot to talk about this week. And to help us out, Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC, joined us earlier this morning. First up, Obama is in Asia this week, 3 days in China, and he spoke at a town hall meeting with Chinese students in Shanghai. Tomorrow, he's going to meet with Hu Jintao and then with Prime Minister Wen Jiabao on Wednesday. This is what President Obama had to say about U.S. and Chinese relations when he was in Tokyo this weekend.
No one nation can meet the challenges of the 21st century alone. And the United States and China will both be better off when we are able to meet them together.
So the president is expected to talk about to Chinese leaders about climate change, nuclear proliferation, and currency. We asked Jonathan Marcus, which of those things does he think President Obama is most likely to make progress on?
I think there might be small progress on many of them. I'm not expecting any dramatic breakthroughs. I think, though, it's really about tone. It's about continuing this effort by successive American administrations to, you know, bring China on board, as the Bush administration used to call it, a responsible stakeholder in the international system. I think increasingly now China is more and more important for the United States. The financial crisis revealed the relationship between the two economies in the starkest terms. But also, when you look more broadly that President Obama's whole approach to the world, his efforts to extend a hand to America's enemies, to place the focus on diplomatic consensus building, clearly China is a key player there, whether it's in dealing with Iran, whether it's a question of dealing with North Korea's nuclear program, whether it's a question of bolstering another key ally of China, Pakistan. So China is more and more important as a player when America looks across a wholly diverging and wide range of foreign policy issues.
Okay, well, we'll be following President Obama during his 3 days in China, but let's move back home to the health care debate. The Senate is waiting for Harry Reid to bring the health care bill to the floor. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking on Fox News Sunday.
Look, we spent 4 weeks on a farm bill in the last Congress, 8 weeks on an energy bill earlier this decade. This will be on the floor for quite a long time. I think it ought to be on the floor at least as long as it's been in Harry Reid's office.
So, Marcus, that sounds like a threat of a filibuster to me.
Well, the Republicans probably won't be able to pull off a filibuster, which is pretty much a Democrat's only hope of this, because if the Republicans could, then this thing is going to die. And if that's the case, then Harry Reid would never bring it to the Senate floor. I think Mitchell McConnell's beating his chest there a little bit and talking about how, you know, we can expect that rhetoric a lot this week. This week we can expect Republicans to say, well, look at how long we've taken to do other important pieces of legislation. Here we're talking about 18% of the American economy. We clearly can't rush it through. Harry Reid can't afford to have it languish for a long time once he introduces it, which probably won't be this week, but we can expect the Republican rhetoric, and already they're putting out some, one might argue, really politically effective ads against Democrats and conservative places that voted for the House version.
So I think many people have been surprised by how large of a discussion there's been over abortion. Is this kind of like the Ralph Nader of the health care bill? Is this kind of like the spoiler that it's splitting up the Democrats and hurting the chances for the health care reform to go through?
Well, this is really, you know, the unseemly part of this whole debate is that what you're looking at here is you're looking at a battle, as we often say, you know, the political cliche, for the future of the Democratic Party, and they're the majority party. And what we're seeing right now is conservatives versus more progressive Democrats, and that battle we can expect to keep going on. There's a real danger here, ironically, for the president, actually. You know, we saw a kind of roll back on the environmental goals and goals for Copenhagen. We're going to see now roll back on abortion rights issues. There could come a point here where the president, who's already having a very hard time convincing conservatives to go along with health care reform, actually faces kind of upheaval from progressives on lots of issues for saying, you know what, you promised us a different kind of leadership and you haven't delivered. He could be in trouble from both ends, and that's what he has to watch out for.
Okay, let's go to Afghanistan now. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the United States has delivered a message to Hamid Karzai. Here she is on This Week with George Stephanopoulos yesterday.
We're looking to see tangible evidence that the government, led by the president, but going all the way down to the local level, will be more responsive to the needs of the people, will deliver the services that the people of Afghanistan want, who do not want a return to the Taliban, but they want a government that actually can function on their behalf.
Okay, so Jonathan, first of all, do we know that Karzai has clearly received that message, and do we expect him to actually heed it and follow those guidelines she just put out?
I think he'd be deaf if he hadn't been hearing that message over successive days and indeed weeks. I think there was every evidence that many people in the Western coalition that are involved in Afghanistan was rather hoping that he might not emerge as Afghanistan's president again. Well, he has. I think for all the demands that he change his ways, and they're clearly sincere, I think maybe people are also beginning to think a little bit about the value of demonizing Mr. Karzai. He's the man they've got. They pushed the democratic process. He emerged as the victor. He's the guy they're going to have to deal with. So clearly there's hope that he gets the message, hope that there will be reform, but not a lot of people I speak to are tremendously convinced that there is going to be a dramatic change in the way the Afghan government runs its affairs.
And President Obama has said that he's going to announce a decision on troop levels in Afghanistan as soon as he returns from Asia. And have we heard anything coming from the Karzai government about their opinion about troop levels and whether they should increase?
Well, I think it's quite clear that more troops are needed. And of course, the Karzai government is very interested in having a stepped-up program of training Afghan police and security forces as well. I mean, this is an announcement that clearly has taken some time for the Obama administration to deliver on. Some people say he's dithering. Some people say he's applying due diligence and looking through all the options very carefully. You can imagine in a country like Britain here, you know, we're talking about the possibility of additional British troops going to Afghanistan all contingent on what the president decides. So this is a huge issue, not just in the United States, but in Britain and indeed in many other European countries who have troops involved on the ground.
Okay, so quickly, Marcus, let's go to Austin, Texas, where we've got Republican governors from all over the country gathering this week. The new governors from New Jersey and Virginia are going to be headed down there. And it seems like lately the story about the Republican Party has been all about infighting. Is that what's going to happen at the meeting in Texas?
Yep.
Okay, so moving on.
That's about it. Yeah, the different sides of the Republican Party take different lessons from what happened in New Jersey and Virginia. The conservatives say this shows us that we can win if we're fighting and aggressive. The moderates say, in fact, it shows us that moderate and centrist candidates can win, especially those who, like the governor of Virginia, who do not emphasize their social conservative backgrounds. He really de-emphasized it. And Chris in New Jersey also didn't really run on a very conservative social agenda. He ran on economic issues. So it's going to be an interesting fight there. We can also expect, look at Charlie Crist. Look and see this week if Charlie Crist, the Republican governor of Florida, has a target on his back.
Marcus Mabry is international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC. That's your agenda for the week. Coming up, time for college kids to come home for the holidays, but how can they feel like they've graduated to being a real adult when they do? This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenmayer. You know, it's been a half century since anyone took these words, The Sound of Music, literally.
My day in the hills has come to an end, I know. A star has come out to tell me.
Yes, 50 years ago today, the hills became alive with music. The Sound of Music opened on Broadway. Rodgers and Hammerstein's hit was an instant success back in 1959. And The Takeaway's music correspondent, Jack Grace, is here to talk about this incredible milestone and the musical legacy from the show, which is unbelievable. You've got The Sound of Music, that song right there, right?
That's, yes, indeed.
Every kid knows, every teenager knows, I'm 16 going on 17.
Well, ones that still have music programs, yes.
Right, exactly. And The Lonely Goat Herd, that's an absolute classic, right?
Mm, yep, sure.
And what kid doesn't learn music by learning this song, Do Re Mi?
Do, a deer, a female deer. Re, a drop of golden sun. Me.
There's also the song Edelweiss, right?
Edelweiss.
It's an absolute classic. Yes, here's indeed. Theodore Bakel singing that song from the original Broadway cast.
There he is, Theodore Bakel from the original, has many stories of how he got this part. The song itself actually was written for him because he had a lot of folk finger-picking abilities. He was a co-founder of the Newport Folk Festival of that same year, 1959.
But it's not some, like, German folk song. It's not some Austrian,
No, that's what everybody thinks. In fact, even Germans will play it at Oktoberfests, German-Americans, thinking that it's some traditional song, and it indeed is not.
You know, one of the great things about The Sound of Music is that it took a very tough subject, Nazism, the Holocaust, World War II, and broached it in 1959 when it was still pretty raw.
Yeah, it was definitely something very new, and a lot of the critics panned it. But definitely, you're thinking, and when you put it in reference, it's about 15 years, and people are still, it's the first time it's really getting close to talking about the Holocaust in a musical.
Well, again, song after song, absolute classics, I don't even have to mention the title of this one.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens. Bright.
Now there you go. That's Mary Martin.
That's Mary Martin from the original cast recording. My Favorite Things. When the Dog Bites. When the Bee Stings. When You're Feeling Bad.
Mm-hmm.
My Favorite Things. Another classic that actually had incredible influence musically across outside of Broadway.
Yeah, well, that was when Coltrane was a few years later, took it and had the album My Favorite Things, and it reintroduced the tenor saxophone to people as you're hearing him right there, and this
Let's listen to Coltrane for a second. As much of a classic as the original Broadway tune.
Yeah, in fact, in a lot of circles, certainly to jazz fans and stuff, they may not have even heard of The Sound of Music. All they know is that song.
Hmm. You know, the sad part about Sound of Music is that it was the last collaboration of Rodgers and Hammerstein, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct, actually. Yeah, Hammerstein died 9 months after the production of Cancer. And an interesting note was that Edelweiss then happened to be the last song that they ever wrote, because they wrote that song after the show had already been cast, and they saw Theodore Bickel and saw what a great figure.
They thought they needed a sort of a folk song in there.
Yeah, so they wrote it for him.
50 years ago today, The Sound of Music premieres on Broadway. Jack Grace, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. So the empty nest is not so empty on holiday weekends like Thanksgiving, when kids come home from college and have to decide, do they want to act like kids or show off how adult they are? It creates tensions in the home. We'll talk about that with Lisa Belkin in just a moment. But we're also talking with you about the serious issue of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, as the self-proclaimed 9/11 mastermind apparently heads to New York for a trial. Can he get a fair trial? Does it matter? And should he go to a military tribunal instead?
This is Craig calling from New Jersey. First of all, as a somewhat reluctant Obama supporter, it's exciting to finally see him take a bold move like this. And I think it's appropriate. Why was this never done?
Good question. Pose yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's a check of leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour. In the headlines, President Obama meeting with Chinese President Hu Jintao for a conversation expected to be dominated by trade and economic issues. Talks taking place in Beijing's Forbidden City. Earlier, while in Shanghai, the president made a clear political point calling on China to free up the internet and to allow full religious freedom, saying they are universal. Back home, General Motors has reported a $1.2 billion loss in the third quarter, despite all the red ink. The latest report from GM is being seen as a sign the automaker is beginning to recover. Figures are better than previous quarters, and the company says it will begin repaying $6.7 billion in government loans next month.
Russia has said a nuclear power station it's been building in southern Iran will not be started up as planned this year. Over the weekend, Moscow called on Iran to respond positively to an international offer to ship its uranium to Russia for enrichment. In Iraq, it's unclear what was behind multiple shootings in a village near Baghdad. 13 people are dead. Iraqi officials say it could have been tribal differences and not insurgents. And now, for more details on the news from GM this morning, we heard that GM is going to start paying back their debt to the government earlier than expected, and they're reporting that they lost $1.2 billion in the third quarter, but that shows progress. So to explain this seemingly confusing position is Paul Eisenstein. He's publisher of thedetroitbureau.com, an online magazine that covers the global auto industry. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Good to be with you, Celeste.
Okay, so they lost $1.2 billion. How good is this news?
Well, in the strange world of the auto industry today, losing $1.2 billion is almost like having a profit in years past. It seems like General Motors is, according to many analysts, on its way towards recovery. Basically, what we're looking at here is a figure that is so distorted by all the unusual elements that we've seen, you know, the bankruptcy and the fact that they're still sorting out all the assets they have left over after the bankruptcy and so on, that you can't compare this to years past. But when you look at it just on the face of the numbers in terms of the post-bankruptcy GM, it's great news.
And they've also said they're going to be starting to pay back the loan from the government that many people said the government would never see again. Is this pretty much saying that the auto industry is on its way back to health, that maybe the big three are making the right decisions?
Well, there's clearly signs that the auto industry, the Detroit auto industry, is showing some improvements. Be careful when you talk about paying back the government, because you have loan money and then you have money that was invested into the company that eventually the government will be able to recover at least some of it when GM goes public again. In other words, when they offer an initial offering, the IPO, in which could start in 2011 or 2012. It now appears that they are not going to be doing it in 2010. But GM is going to pay back this roughly $7 billion of loan money at a rate of about $1 billion a quarter.
Well, we'll see if they continue to be healthy. That's Paul Eisenstein, publisher of thedetroitbureau.com.
Pull out of the shadows and find eventually. There we are, what we are, and what we are is still family.
And on our family segment this morning, we're going to play a little song lyric here. Listen to this and tell me if you don't think this is about, for a lot of families, the elephant in the room issue.
Home cooked meals and my rent is free. Stay up all night, then I sleep filthy. Life is good, well, happy birthday to me. Because I'm still living at home at age 23.
23? Living at home? Well, Thanksgiving is about a lot of things, but for many families, it's a test of the empty nest. College-age kids return home on break, find their rooms have been converted to home offices. Also, fledgling adults sometimes have difficulty deciding whether they want to revert to childhood or just show off how grown up they are. Takeaway Family Contributor Lisa Belkin joins us now. She writes the family and parenting blog Motherload for the New York Times. She's writing on this very subject today for the blog. Lisa, good morning.
Good morning.
So the issue of kids living at home till late and also coming back home from college and kind of creating tensions at home is really quite a big issue. What do you have on this subject for us this morning?
Well, I have my own son coming home in about a week. So it's that song. Oh, my goodness. not the Jaws one, the one you just played. Yep. It's the first time they've been away. They have established a bit of their own life. And now they're reentering, and is the same person reentering into the same place that it was when you all last saw each other? And no, of course not. And you have to figure out the new rules, the new dynamic.
So, Cortez Riley, you're a 21-year-old student at the University of Minnesota. You're headed home for, what, about the fourth time now?
About the fourth time.
Any advice for moms on dealing with a 21-year-old like yourself, and what are your frustrations?
From my past experiences, I feel that going home, it has been a bit awkward. Obviously, I love my family, but I guess I've kind of gotten used to my life at college. And so when I've gone home, it's kind of like I've had to adjust. So I guess some advice that I definitely can give to some parents is to, I guess comfort the children, of course, as much as they possibly can. And, you know, be mindful that they have changed just because they have been in college and they've been experiencing new things. And I know trying to get to know themselves. And so, you know, just be mindful of the change and see what you can do to, you know, accommodate the change and
okay.
things like that.
All right. Lisa Belkin, how do you set rules about things like drinking and, going out till, 3 in the morning?
Well, ideally, the experts tell us, you've started this conversation already before they left, and I haven't, so, and I suspect most people haven't, so you have to start it when they come home, and I think you just have to assume that they have had a different life there than they do at home, and confront that, and then it has to be what you can live with. Is it okay with you if this child now comes and goes as he or she pleases the way she did at school? I don't know where my son is on an average night here, but I don't necessarily want to be up at 3 a.m. worrying about him because he's within arm's reach. So talk about that. Talk about whether or not they need to clean up after themselves in a better way than they might have at school.
All right. So, Chris Shea, you're also on the line. You're a dad. You have 3 kids, 2 of which are in their early 20s. So did you set rules and talk about this beforehand and plan carefully for this kind of tension?
Well, good morning, everyone. Ideally, that's what all parents would do, but no, we weren't the perfect at that. But what Lisa's been talking about is very true when it comes down to the importance of communication and asking questions and definitely acknowledging that your children are now growing up and becoming young adults.
How do you regulate issues like drinking and staying out late? And you're actually a substance abuse counselor, so I imagine it would be a little tough in your house.
It can be, and it's definitely different when you're dealing with your own than what my work is. And I am kind of lucky being a clinician, and also with my work on young adults at Father Martin's Ashley has kind of helped prep me. But really what we try to do when they are home is just to ask open-ended questions and help and aid in that communication.
Cortez Riley, where do you sleep when you go home? Do you still have your old room?
No, my family actually moved to a different house.
I hate it when that happens.
So I know. So, you know, I didn't have a room. So every time I go home, I usually have to sleep in, like, my mom's bed, a little sister's room, or on a little room, something like that.
All right. Well, Cortez, have a great Thanksgiving, and try to be gentle with your parents. Chris Shea, good luck to you, and happy Thanksgiving. And Lisa Belkin, you want to give us a last thought before we go?
Yeah, my son's room is there, but it's cleaner.
Lisa Belkin writes the Family and Parenting blog for the New York Times. That's our family segment this morning.
There's a world where I can go and tell my secrets to.
Yeah, what's it like in your room? If you want to comment on that segment, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're going to talk about work tomorrow. So are people acting more ethically in the workplace? Take a guess. Are people more or less ethical? You can call in with your experience at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Or mytake at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
President Obama is in China today, meeting with local politicians and government officials. What could they be talking about, I wonder?
Money, 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 must be funny in the rich man's fund.
In 1979, trade between the United States and China stood at roughly $5 billion. Today, it tops over $400 billion each year.
The dollar is down everywhere except China. Are the Chinese trying to maintain the current enormous trade deficit? Talks in China will cover global warming, human rights, and a growing arms buildup. But in the end,
it's a rich man's world.
But what does he have in his wallet? A greenback or a yen? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, November 16th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. Coming up, you got economics, freakonomics, and super freakonomics. All week, we look at the world through the lens of super freakonomics with Stephen Dubner. And Congress moves on the Fort Hood shootings. Truman Capote began writing In Cold Blood 50 years ago today, and a welterweight championship shakes up the fight game.
But first, Mary Kay Magstad, China correspondent for PRI's The World, joins us. Mary Kay, from what we understand, President Obama really had to work hard to get China to agree to this American-style town hall meeting with students this morning. What was so significant about getting to this town hall meeting?
Well, it was a negotiation. Basically, the Chinese like to be able to control things like this, and the U.S. side wanted a very freewheeling town hall kind of meeting. And what they got was something in between, where there were a couple hundred students, a lot of them handpicked, and the students' questions seemed like they had been very carefully selected as well. But at least there was some exchange, and President Obama actually was able to get in a couple of comments on the importance of the free flow of information and how he's very anti-censorship.
Were there any questions that were surprising or unexpected? Any bombs about human rights or anything else?
Not really. The closest one to that was the one that asked about internet censorship and how he felt about the way the internet was developing in China. And he really, you know, kind of ran with that and said quite a bit about how he thought that it was important for him as a leader to hear from people who didn't like him, you know, so he could think about how he was governing and how he could improve.
Okay, Mary Kay Magstad, stay with us. She's the China correspondent for PRI's The World. We'll be back with you in a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
Probably less discussion of the internet, but President Obama is now in meetings with the Chinese president this morning in Beijing. It comes hours after those questions at a town hall type meeting in Shanghai, where he stressed the U.S. and China are not adversaries and insisted that the U.S. does not seek to contain China's rise. Big story out of General Motors. It says it lost $1.2 billion from the time it left bankruptcy protection through the end of September. And that's positive news, far better than the $10 billion GM burned through in the first quarter. This comes hours after we learned the company will start repaying its debt to the U.S. government sooner than expected.
NASA is fueling the space shuttle Atlantis for its afternoon liftoff. Atlantis scheduled to blast off shortly before 2:30 on a mission to stockpile the International Space Station with big spare parts. There's a 70% 10% chance the weather will cooperate. And the movie 2012 spelled doom for the competition over the weekend. The disaster movie opened at the top of the box office. Not a disaster, though. They raked in $65 million domestically, $225 million worldwide.
It's a disaster for the Christmas Carol.
The Dow is going to open this hour at 10,270. The S&P starts trade at 1093. And the NASDAQ begins at 2168.
Self-proclaimed 9/11 mastermind heads to New York and for a possible trial. Does it matter? Should he or any of the Guantanamo detainees go to a military tribunal instead? It's a question we're asking you this morning. 877-8MYTAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. There's disagreement in Congress over whether there should be a federal criminal trial for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and there's disagreement among you. You've been responding all morning. Give us your take at 877-8MYTAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
These freedoms of expression and worship, of access to information and political participation, we believe are universal rights. They should be available to all people, including ethnic and religious minorities, whether they are in the United States, China, or any nation.
That's President Obama speaking at a town hall meeting with Chinese students in Shanghai this morning. It's part of his week-long Asia tour. And supposedly one of the times when he became most frank in his discussion with students. We're rejoined by Mary Kay Magstad. She's China correspondent for PRI's The World. Good morning again, Mary Kay.
Good morning.
So what we just heard right there, as you said, was the time when he was able to speak most openly about potentially controversial topics, correct?
Well, that was one of the points where he hit human rights in the course of his hour-long town hall meeting. And there are certainly human rights advocates who would have liked to have seen him hit it harder, to have actually talked about some of the issues within China. But it was clear he was trying to walk sort of a fine line between not wanting to totally annoy his host before he's even met President Hu Jintao and making his point. And later on, when he got to talking about the importance of the free flow of information and of not censoring the internet, not censoring information, he did kind of get more to a central point that does affect China.
This reference to ethnic and religious minorities, is that kind of a polite version way of bringing up the Uyghurs?
Bring up the Uyghurs and the Tibetans, both.
Right.
There have been crackdowns in both places over the last couple of years. And when it's brought up, the Chinese government generally says, mind your own business. It's an internal affair. And what President Obama was saying, somewhat obliquely, but saying nonetheless, was human rights are universal rights, and they belong to ethnic minorities within China as much as they belong to people anywhere else.
You were saying earlier this hour that the Chinese kind of like to keep control of these kind of press events, and President Obama got a certain amount of concessions from them in leading this town hall meeting. So is there no precedence for this kind of sort of open, supposedly open discussion with people in China, among other past presidents?
There is a precedent. When President Clinton came here in the 1990s, he not only met with students, but he also actually had a joint press conference with then-President Jiang Zemin that was broadcast live. And at that point, during that press conference, President Clinton brought up the Tiananmen crackdown of 1989 and said that basically, in history, China will be shown to have been on the wrong side of history and having done that. And since then, I think China's leaders have become a little more cautious about letting Americans have quite so freewheeling a platform to state their views.
I can imagine. One of the things I'm sure that the president will be talking with the president of China tomorrow is currency. We know he's going to talk about that. We're joined also by David Barboza, Shanghai correspondent for our partner in the New York Times. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
So we've heard a lot about the problem with currency, that they have been linking the yuan to the American dollar, which means that many people criticize the Chinese for supposedly devaluing their currency as the dollar goes down. Explain very quickly, why is this a problem, and why would the Chinese want to devalue their currency?
Well, it's been going on for a long time. Actually, they had pegged the renminbi to the dollar for decades, and they sort of released that peg in 2005 as a concession that they wanted to be more market-oriented. In other words, the demand of the market would determine whether their currency was weak or strong. But once the financial crisis hit, they again kind of quietly pegged it again to the dollar to sort of hold it stable to help their exporters. And as you probably know, I mean, having a weaker currency helped your exporters. Having a stronger currency helps your importers. If you're importing oil or other things, it, you have a higher value currency, it's cheaper. But if you're helping your exporters, you want a kind of a weaker currency. And many other major currencies are more market-oriented, like the dollar, and it depends on supply and demand. But China wants is an export-led economy. It's driven this growth mostly through helping trade and helping the exporters, the Chinese factories, and even the American companies who are in China exporting from here. And so that's why they want a weaker currency.
Right. So, Mary Kay, can the U.S. force China to appreciate the currency? Can anyone in the world force China to take action on this issue?
I don't think force is the right word, but encourage, certainly. And President Obama has been hitting this point several times already during his Asia swing, where he's been saying, look, the world can't continue to look to the American consumer to drive their economies by buying exports, cheap exports from places like China. China should encourage domestic consumption. China should look for other ways to grow its economy. And the Chinese government will likely move in the next year or two, when it feels that things have stabilized a little bit, to loosening up the restraints on the yuan, on the renminbi, and letting it float a little bit more. It was always floating within a narrow band and against a basket of currencies that included the euro and the Japanese yen. They'll probably move in that direction again, but they'll do it when they feel that domestic conditions are right, the same way that the American administration makes decisions, makes financial decisions to some extent on what's best for the American public.
Well, Mary Kay and David, let me just ask you directly, David Barboza of The New York Times. It seems to me that the dialogue on this currency question has shifted, and that maybe it's a recognition that both countries, the U.S. and China, are way in over their heads. They've made this kind of deal, and they have to live or die by the dollar. The Chinese hold way too many dollars to be terribly flexible in their policy, and the U.S. is way too indebted to the Chinese to have much leverage here.
That's right. That's right. In that situation is why this time around, Washington or the Obama administration they have less weight in arguing for the Chinese to do something about their currency, because right now we need the Chinese to buy treasury bills and to help finance the U.S. debt, the increasingly large U.S. debt. And the Chinese now feel kind of emboldened that they have a lot of clout, they have a lot of sway, and they can say, you know, wait a minute, we want you to fix your own fiscal problems and don't throw it on us and make us throw out our migrant workers out of work. So we have kind of like almost a little mini currency war going on. The U.S. wants a stronger renminbi, and China wants a stronger dollar, because they're holding their investments in a lot of dollars. So it's a kind of like a just mini war.
Well, we'll see what happens with that. That's David Barboza, Shanghai correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, and Mary Kay Magstad, China correspondent for PRI's The World. Thanks to both of you. And it's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on some of the stories worth following.
The top story: General Motors is reporting a $1.2 billion loss in the third quarter, which sounds bad, but despite it, the figures are better than previous quarters and maybe a sign the automaker is beginning to actually recover. The company says it will, as a result, begin repaying $6.7 billion in government loans next month. That's earlier than scheduled. Meanwhile, the Commerce Department says retail sales rose 1.4% last month. Most of that is a rebound in auto sales, but take the figure out and retail demand was up just 0.2%, which is why it's not having much of an effect on futures trading. Wall Street expected to be flat too positive when the trading gets underway on Wall Street. As we've been discussing, President Obama is in Beijing for talks with China's leaders, already making a pointed pitch for human rights by urging China to stop censoring the internet. He said freedom of expression was a universal right, speaking to young people in Shanghai.
I have never used Twitter. I noticed that young people, you know, they're very busy with all these electronics. My thumbs are too clumsy to type in things on the phone.
It was a long, rambling discussion about the internet and the freedoms
it
of the internet in that town.
It's universal right not to be on Twitter there. Our partner, the BBC, has been out and about on the streets of Beijing looking for Chinese reaction to President Obama's arrival in the city. Here's one woman who said he's welcome in her city.
I don't know him very much. I just know he is the president of America. And I think he is okay. Yes, I like him.
Staying abroad, four people have been killed in northwest Pakistan. A truck laden with explosives blew up outside a police station. Militants have killed more than 300 people in the area in the past month. And according to a new survey, most Americans agree that major health care changes are needed, but they're divided about the Democratic overhaul plans. The Associated Press poll suggests the public is worried that there are hidden costs lurking in the fine print. I don't know where they'd get that idea. That's a look at some of the stories that we're following this morning.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Oh, yeah, news takeout this morning. Stories we want you to stay on top of this week. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, joins us. So, Todd, the Fort Hood shootings took place a week ago last Thursday. President Obama warned that Congress should stay clear of this terrible tragedy in terms of hearings and investigations until the military is done with its investigations. But it looks like Congress isn't heeding that warning at all.
Yeah, they're not. Good morning, John. And often Congress doesn't heed the warnings of the executive. You know, you get into these warnings and then you start to get into turf battles and separation of powers. So Congress is going to start to hold hearings on Fort Hood. Now, they start this morning, not a hearing technically, but a briefing. Army Secretary John McHugh and General Casey, Army Chief of Staff, coming to the Senate Armed Services Committee this morning to brief senators in a closed briefing, not a hearing, as I said, on what we know and what is known about the Fort Hood shootings, how they happened, and who knew what and when. That's happening this morning. And then Judiciary Committee Chairman Patrick Leahy over the weekend saying that his committee will conduct hearings into the Fort Hood shootings. Now, Attorney General Eric Holder is scheduled to come up onto the Hill on Wednesday to talk about other broader issues at the Justice Department, but Leahy saying he probably will be asked about Fort Hood and what the FBI knew about that and what they're doing about it. So it's not an official hearing on Fort Hood, but it's certainly going to come up.
Very quickly, Todd, what oversight does Congress have here? Is it the sort of state of play inside security of bases? Does Congress have anything to say about that? Is it the extent to which the FBI is watching the military and notifies the military of their own terrorism investigations? What sort of thing?
Well, Congress always has oversight because they control the purse strings and they control the laws. So if Congress needs to change military law, they can certainly do that. One thing the White House is looking at is how the intelligence services handled what they knew about Hassan. Of course, remember, some of his colleagues were concerned about him and they knew that he was communicating with radical imams up to a year before these attacks. So if Congress determines that laws weren't strong enough, or the intelligence services either didn't have enough authority or didn't follow the authority that they had to prevent an attack like this, certainly they could either throw more money at the problem, as they often do, or crack down on some intelligence laws or security laws.
Well, and when you're in Article 1 of the Constitution, everyone else stands in line. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, talking about congressional oversight. Thanks, Todd. So over the weekend, maybe you were watching NFL players batting each other around on the field, but our Takeaway sports contributor Ibrahim Abdelmateen says Saturday night was all about boxing.
Cotto stopped late on against Margarito. Will it happen again? And Kenny Bayless says no more! Manny Pacquiao has another sensational night! He is a five-weight world champion! An unbelievable display yet again!
Filipino Manny Pacquiao against Miguel Cotto from Puerto Rico, and this was the biggest welterweight fight in almost a decade. What was the significance of this bout, Ibrahim?
Well, first of all, Manny Pacquiao, who's probably going to run for Congress in the Philippines, he's the most popular right. Filipino in the world. He may be duly noted as one of the best of all times. Put him in a category as Ali and Frazier and Sugar Ray. He's won 7 titles in 7 weight classes. He's the first person to do that.
Now, so wait, he's a welterweight?
Correct. He's a
but
welterweight.
But how can you have 5 different weights as titles?
He's basically moved up. Every time he's won one, he's moved up. He's won one, he's moved up. With Cotto, he started as a teenager, and then now he's reached his highest weight class. the question was whether he was going to be heavy-handed enough in this to win against Cotto. But what he did was that he comes with both fists, he hits both ways, and he comes at different angles. So people don't know. Cotto was saying, I didn't know where he was, the punches were coming from. I didn't know how he was hitting me. And he bloodied him up. His face was beaten, battered and bruised at all places.
So he's a power hitter and he's a real stylist as
well. He's got the footwork of Muhammad Ali. So he's a dangerous, dangerous fighter. Cotto was the underdog, even though he was bigger. Even though he got some good shots in on him, he still was getting battered by the smaller Pacquiao.
Are people going to follow the welterweight game, though, like they followed the heavyweights in the traditional sort of Muhammad Ali days?
So the big talk now is, obviously, is he going to fight Floyd Mayweather? And Mayweather-Pacquiao could be a fight as big as Ali and Frazier in 71.
Right.
That's the level that these fighters are at now.
And this was a pay-per-view event like no other. We don't know the purse, but $54 at least it cost you to watch the fight. Hey, Ibrahim, thanks so much. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports Contributor.
Good morning.
Our last takeout comes from you, the listeners. We've been asking all morning long, as the self-proclaimed 9/11 mastermind heads to trial in New York, can Khalid Sheikh Mohammed get a fair trial, and does it matter? Or should he go to a military tribunal instead?
I think the question comes down to, what do you consider terrorism, an act of war or a crime? It's an act of war, and we should prosecute it accordingly, and I think the military tribunal is the best venue for that.
This is Craig calling from New Jersey. First of all, as a somewhat reluctant Obama supporter, it's exciting to finally see him take a bold move like this, and I think it's appropriate. Why was this never done?
For many of you, what this all comes down to is politics.
He is simply a prisoner of war and needs to be treated as such. He has no place in a civil court. He needs to be in a military court. There should be zero spin in this issue.
Everyone knows this is a ploy by Obama just to expose Bush. Why else would Eric Holder say it's been 8 long years and finally? It's just their opportunity to try to get Bush blamed.
And there are some interesting takes we've been getting from New Yorkers on whether or not the trial should take place in their hometown.
If I picked any city in the world, I'd pick New York to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, because I think that the New Yorkers understand that more than being revenge seekers, the Constitution establishes our justice system in this country, and we can see both sides of that coin and judge fairly.
It will make Lower Manhattan a focal point for every crazy who wants to say something about terrorism in the world. And if the cops can keep the lid on that, which I'm sure they can, what neighborhood do you sacrifice? Saying that human resources are limited, money, if it has any value, is limited. What neighborhood are you going to sacrifice? I don't see that this makes any sense practically or symbolically.
Keep it coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, super freakonomics, the lens through which all reality can be provided new insights. Stephen Dubner's with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Stephen Dubner's here to talk about super freakonomics. You take reality, you add super freakonomics to it. What insights do you find? We're going to talk about that in just a few moments. But right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 30 minutes past the hour. President Obama sat down with Chinese President Hu Jintao in Beijing this morning to discuss trade and economic issues. And earlier, the president encouraged China to ease its restrictions on the internet in a town hall meeting in Shanghai. Here at home, General Motors lost only $1.2 billion last quarter, and that's great news. That's right, for the troubled car maker. To give you a better understanding why, consider the GM lost $10 billion in the first quarter. It comes as GM says it will start repaying its government debt earlier than expected.
Federal officials will inspect a prison in rural Illinois to determine if it would make a good site to house the Guantanamo Bay detainees. The plan would create thousands of new jobs, but it's meeting resistance from those who believe housing the suspected terrorists would be dangerous. That's a look at some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Aww, freak out.
Ooh, freakonomics.
Listeners of The Takeaway will know that the Freakonomics theme song needs to be replaced by a super Freakonomics theme. And we're joined all week long as we retool our branding by our friend Stephen Dubner, who is co-author of the Freakonomics book and blog, and now the new book, Super Freakonomics, global cooling, patriotic prostitutes, and why suicide bombers should buy life insurance. The premise of this week is, aside from loving to spend time with Stephen Dubner, is, Stephen, two books under your belt now, long years collaborating with your co-author, Stephen Levitt, a University of Chicago professor. Seems to me the Freakonomics view of life itself is kind of a lens, and it needs to be explained. What is the Freakonomics way of looking at things? And then let's take it to something in the news like healthcare.
So it's pretty simple. Basically, we use what are broadly thought of as the tools of economics.
Stephen Levitt and I,
who is, as you mentioned, a research economist at the University of Chicago. And we use those tools, which are usually applied to what most people think of as the economy. So there's a whole breed of economists who are what you call macroeconomists, who deal with the big economy that people think about, inflation, the stock market, recessions, jobs, and so on. We don't touch that. I could talk about for hours why we don't touch it, but it's not that interesting and it's not apropos right now. What we do is we do something more called microeconomics. And what that is really using the tools of economics, which are ways of thinking about the world and some techniques, and apply them to things other than the economy, whether it's prostitution or global warming. So it's what we call the economic approach. It's a way of looking at the world kind of with neither fear nor favor. We are equal opportunity offenders. There are times when people on the left will hate us, times when people on the right will hate us. Sometimes they'll decide to hate us together. We do hope to produce or provoke even conversation of a different sort that's usually provoked. And the reason is this. Most people, when they think about things, whether it's big things in their lives or small things, they approach them with a kind of predisposed bias that is built on emotion and anecdote and opinion. We try to throw all that emotion, anecdote, opinion out and use data instead. And that's the goal.
Take lots of data and throw assumptions out and you get
super Freakonomics.
All right, let's.
You didn't buy the song. That was too expensive.
We can afford our own branding for you, yeah. Stephen Dubner. Let's just apply this. Take data to some of our assumptions about healthcare, and of course, the healthcare reform debate is filled with all sorts of conventional wisdom and assumptions. First of all, let's apply it there. And what surprises do you come up with?
Well, first of all, let me say it's been really interesting to read both sides of, let's say, all the media on this. When you read the New York Times, you get one picture. When you read the Journal, you get another picture. But what's interesting is that people are tearing apart the system and examining it in a way that we didn't usually. Mm-hmm. One conclusion that people are getting to a lot is cost is paramount, which we can talk about. But another thing is the overconsumption of goods. Now, if you think about medical care, health care, not like a life-saving intervention, which we tend to think of it as, but instead as a good that we all consume, there's a great argument to be made that whenever you have an all-you-can-eat menu of any kind, think of it as you go to a restaurant, you pay $9.99 for the buffet, you're probably going to eat more than if you're buying a la carte.
Is that how you would characterize the current state of the healthcare economy, all-you-can-eat menu?
Well, if you think about it depends what you have.
For those who are covered.
Yeah, it depends who you are and what you have. But a big problem is that a lot of people have an all-you-can-eat medical plan, which means that they consume more. So one of the big problems seems to be overconsumption of resources, and that does a few things. Ties up doctors, crowds out the sick, results in a lot of unnecessary medical care. Basically, what it contributes to is a lot of rising costs.
Now, so the presence of the all-you-can-eaters affects people at the high and the low end of the spectrum because it crowds out resources for everybody.
Absolutely. Okay. If you're one of the many millions of people who can't get insurance or doesn't want to buy insurance because it's too expensive, you have to think about what's making it so expensive. One of the things that's making it so expensive is the plans that people own where they can consume a lot and do. That racks up an awful lot of costs. Plus, there's demand. That's the other thing.
Right.
You know, we like to talk about how terrible healthcare is in this country. Well, if it were so terrible, people wouldn't be consuming so much. I really think that is a canard that should be dealt with more often.
All right. So doctors can control costs. They're in control here.
Well, it depends. This is where it gets sticky.
Right.
The incentives are, as you know, misaligned and perverse all over the place. Different doctors, depending on what specialty you're in, depending on which building you're in, their incentives for giving care are they're various. Let's say
so a TB doctor has one set of incentives and a plastic surgeon has another set of incentives.
Well, I'd have to think about that particular, but yeah. But look, we write about oncology and chemotherapy in the book. Now, this is a depressing example and a startling example to me. So we looked at chemotherapy. Turns out that if you look at the Medicare budget, for instance, 20% of Medicare cases are cancer patients, okay? But the drug budget, Medicare drug budget, about 40% is consumed by cancer. Now, a lot of that has to do with the fact that chemotherapy is incredibly expensive. So you say, well, wait a minute.
It's also popular. I mean, people it's, think it's very popular. You're diagnosed with cancer, chemotherapy, that's the next step. Everybody
absolutely. Absolutely. Now, here's the problem. On some cancers, and in some cases, chemotherapy is incredibly effective. In many cases, and in many cancers, however, chemotherapy is remarkably ineffective. For a long list where it's been shown that chemo has almost zero discernible effect, including multiple myeloma, soft tissue sarcoma, and many cancers of the solid organs. Now, the question is, why do we consume so much chemo when it's not so effective in so many cases, not in all cases? One reason is that oncologists stand to profit from administering chemotherapy, not just diagnosing the use of it, but from administering. So roughly 50% of an oncologist's revenue stream is actually from the sale and administering of chemotherapy drugs. This is not to say that most oncologists aren't working very hard to do everything they can for their patients, but you can't ignore the profit motive.
Who's going to tell the oncologist to sort out the ineffective chemotherapy treatments from the effective ones based on your data?
Well, this is what's really interesting about it. You think, who's paying for this? Well, the people who tell oncologists that they're going to pay for the chemo generally are the healthcare CEOs and the CEOs of corporations and institutions that buy insurance for their
right.
employees. The fact of the matter, you know, the most emotional moment I had in reporting this book was when I was talking to a very, very good and very bright and very devoted cancer doc who's a research oncologist and a clinical oncologist. He told me, here's the problem. We know that chemo is often very ineffective. The problem is, even for us oncologists who've done it many times, it's very hard to sit face-to-face with a person and say, I'm sorry to tell you this, you have cancer, you're dying, and there's nothing we can do. So even for a doctor, that's hard, and therefore chemo comes in often.
And indeed, the healthcare reform debate really doesn't include these kinds of tough questions. On tomorrow's show, we're going to ask Stephen Dubner what Freakonomics has found out about global warming, some unusual and unpopular ways that we might cool our planet in the Freakonomics view of things. Tune in for that.
Super Freakonomics.
Stephen Dubner here all week, taking the super Freakonomics lens and applying it to all sorts of aspects of headlines in the news and conventional wisdoms that we're going to dispel.
There's
myth
so many
busting
things that you can right. bust myths about. I mean, it almost boggles the mind how the different ways you can apply that theory to accepted wisdom.
Freakonomics regarding breakfast cereal.
Hmm? Absolutely.
Hmm? Let's ask him.
Freakonomics regarding my choice of clothing every day.
Coming up today, Truman Capote's In Cold Blood is 50 years old. At least that's when the story appeared that the book is based on. We're going to talk about that later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. There's weird things going on in every city, right? I mean, you're driving into work or taking the train or whatever, and you see some odd thing and you go, gee, I wonder what's going on with that. I wish I knew what was behind that. Well, our guest, Alicia Zuckerman, is getting those answers for the people of South Florida. She's the co-host of Under the Sun. It's a new public radio series on WLRN in Miami. Alicia joins us now. So the way this works, Alicia, as I understand it, is you let listeners vote on which mysteries your staff is going to solve, right?
That's right. It actually started on Facebook. So before we were even on the air, we were asking the questions on Facebook.
Okay, so
we had
voting.
About 500 people.
Voting is going to end today. You have three finalists. The first one is that people want to know about the naked carpet guy. What's that?
That's right. This is sort of an iconic institution sort of in South Florida, this carpet guy here. There are these billboards all over the place of this naked guy sprawled out on a carpet. His arm is strategically placed. And in a couple iterations, I've seen him wearing briefs, but that sort of goes back and forth. And way back when we first started this thing, we got a query into our Facebook page about this. But then pretty recently, we got an email from his wife. And she wrote, my husband, Don Bailey, Sr., age 76, would be an interesting person for your show. I see how people respond to him. He's a hoot. Practically everyone knows his naked carpet advertising sign. So his wife actually nominated him for this What's Up with South Florida.
Because people are wondering, why is he naked and what's with the carpet?
Okay. His wife is wondering.
Exactly. <Yeah. laughs> Another thing they asked about was ghosts at the Biltmore Hotel.
Right. The Biltmore Hotel, this legendary sprawling hotel in Coral Gables, right outside of Miami. Sightings apparently include a woman in a white dress who is said to have jumped from a window, a man in a top hat playing piano, and a New York gangster who opens the doors for waitresses. So people want to know if the Biltmore is really haunted. And actually, we had a request to have one of our, a specific reporter put on this one. They want to hear our ghost hunter, Kenny Malone, do this.
They wanted to scare this reporter, or they just think he'd do a good job?
They think he'd do a good job. He's good at sort of the quirky stories.
So. There's more weird stuff in Miami, I think, than most cities. That's great for you.
It's true.
The last finalist is rising ocean levels.
Yeah, the tone changes considerably here, huh?
Yeah.
So this one actually is a serious question. I think it's our most serious query to date, if I'm not mistaken. It's the question is Miami Beach going to be underwater in 10 years? Seriously. No one talks about it, but almost every scientist, he says, this is a quote, almost every scientist agrees that something is going to give. As with the levees in New Orleans, I hope it won't be deja vu all over again. So we'll see. Voting ends at the end of the day today, and we'll find out which one we're going to send one of our reporters to go get some answers.
How did this old whole idea start, other than someone just being curious quickly?
Well, I was I live in Miami Beach, and I kept seeing this truck covered in photographs of cannabis leaves all over the truck. And I thought, I actually literally said, I think out loud to myself, what's up with the pot truck? And I put it in the mix for this thing when we came up with this idea to get listeners involved in the show. And it didn't win. It's a democratic process.
Because everyone knew
even
but
though
you.
I co-created the show, but I can't get an answer to this question.
Well, you could do, why is that crane there in Miami? That's always a mystery.
Well, cranes, those
construction
would have to be plural.
Cranes.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. That's Alicia Zuckerman. She is the co-host of Under the Sun, a new public radio series on WLRN in Miami. And we have actually a link to the What's Up With That voting on our website at thetakeaway.org. But we're also asking you, what are your ideas? What do you see on your daily life that you're wondering about and you want to get the answer to? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. What's got you wondering?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Celeste Headlee here at John Hockenberry. Coming up, it's been 50 years since Truman Capote was paging through the New York Times and saw a mention of a murder of a farmer and his family in Kansas. We're going to talk about the history and impact of the book In Cold Blood in a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. President Obama is in Beijing for talks with the Chinese leadership. Earlier in Shanghai, he talked to a group of young people at a town hall event. He called on China to stop censoring the internet and said freedom of expression was a universal right. One of the Chinese students who attended the event in Shanghai is Qian Jing.
The message for me is he is a president who really tried to communicate with average Chinese people, not kind of people who are just telling you the order, what things to do or what things not to do, but he is really the listener who really want to listen to what you really think and really get your real feedback.
The president is now giving his feedback on a range of issues affecting U.S.-China relations to President Hu Jintao in the Chinese capital. GM has reported a $1.2 billion loss in the third quarter, but that's not bad as it seems. The figures are better than previous quarters and maybe a sign the automaker is beginning to recover. The company says it will begin repaying $6.7 billion in government loans next month.
Which may be part of the reason why there's a rally underway on Wall Street. Dow Jones Industrial Average up almost 100 points in the early going this morning. The Commerce Department says retail sales rose 1.4% last month. Most of that is a rebound in auto sales, but take the figure out and retail demand was up just 0.2%. Police officials in Afghanistan say militants have attacked a checkpoint, killing at least three policemen. One local official put the death toll as high as 8. In neighboring Pakistan, a familiar story, a truck bomb in the northwest of the country, at least 4 dead and many, many injured. The bomb targeted a police station. And in Rome, the UN Food Summit has opened with a call by the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon for a more coordinated approach to the problem of world hunger. Here's David Loin of the BBC.
Ban Ki-moon said that the poorest people in the world had been caught in a vicious cycle in the last year that had threatened many millions of lives. Rising food prices meant that people could afford less health care and education, making the fight to cut poverty harder to win. He said there had been some progress to reverse the decline in investment in agriculture since the food price spikes at the end of 2007. But much of the money promised had not materialized, and the levels promised were not at the level needed. He said that the $44 billion required for developing countries was far less than the $365 billion that developed countries spend to subsidize their farmers every year. But this looks as if it will be a summit long on rhetoric, but short on concrete actions.
BBC's international development correspondent David Loyne reporting from Rome.
One day I was just thumbing through the New York Times, and way in the back part of the New York Times I saw this small item, prominent wheat grower slain. Somehow it triggered the idea in my mind, a crime, if one followed a crime from beginning to end.
That's Truman Capote explaining about the article he came across in the New York Times 50 years ago today. It was about a family that was killed in their rural Kansas home. The article itself was only about 355 words, but it inspired Capote to begin investigating that crime, and his investigation ended up becoming In Cold Blood, a novel, a journalistic, literary, nonfiction novel that actually almost created that genre. Joining us now is Patricia Cornwell. She's America's best-selling crime writer and a forensic pathologist herself. Also, true crime television journalist Bill Curtis. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
First, Patricia, can I ask you what is your personal connection to In Cold Blood? Did you read it young or as an adult? And what effect did it have on you?
I believe I first read that when I was a journalist, which is what I started out doing right after college, a long time ago. And I read it several times since, and in addition to it just being gripping and incredibly chilling, it's just a masterpiece, as you were describing, of what I would almost call nonfiction fiction. It's a nonfiction that reads like a novel, and I think it's whetted the appetite, or it did whet the appetite for our fascination, not only into the mind of killers, but in reconstructing a blow-by-blow account of how crimes occur.
Bill, you yourself, when did you first encounter In Cold Blood?
I was in high school, and I was in Kansas, really hit home there.
Yeah, and what did you think of it? It obviously must have made you more curious about this kind of topic since it's become your career.
Well, we were afraid. Everyone was afraid. It's sort of like in the neighborhood where a crime occurs. You say, oh, it couldn't happen here, but it did. And so, you know, here is a rural town, a citizen who is supposedly well off, the perfect American family, and all of a sudden shotgun strangled and death stalked the wheat fields of Kansas. And, of course, there were all these stories about this strange little man who came from New York City and befriended everyone from K-State to the KBI, the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, to produce this.
Patricia, you mentioned earlier that this whetted people's appetite to go into the minds of the killer. And, you know, I was just wondering, Thomas Wolfe kind of famously said about In Cold Blood that it was not so much a whodunit or a will they get away with it as one that promises gory details, he says, if you read it to the end. And I'm wondering, do you think that this fascination is for these gory details more? Or is it the fact that most people themselves are incapable of this kind of act and they're fascinated by the personality of someone who is able to cold-bloodedly slaughter a family of four?
Well, I do think that people are even more fascinated with these details than they ever were. The more they get, the more they want, not only on television, which Bill is more than a little familiar with, but also in literature. And I think that part of it is, I always describe it, that we're fascinated by what we fear. We all know that we're going to die. We don't want to. We're scared of it, and we're particularly afraid of violence. So we want to get close to it, but feel safe. And one way to do that is to watch things on television or read books where we get lots of details. And, of course, In Cold Blood is a perfect example of this because it's such a masterful and, detailed reconstruction of what actually happened in that terrible case of the family being murdered, that you're riveted, and Bill's right. It must have promoted tremendous fear in the area where it happened.
Well, Bill and Patricia, I mean, the one character that isn't in Cold Blood is Truman Capote, and he didn't show up in the movie. And I'm wondering, how do you answer the notion that his whole methodology, Capote's, was exploitive? And you alluded to the deals that he made sort of with all the characters to produce this. And, novel, there means there's some fiction in there. As a journalist, how do you react to that?
Well, he did have masterful detail. right down to the cat walking across the street in Holcomb, Kansas, and going to the one restaurant, so that you're painting a portrait that is incredible. It also may have started this new fiction. Remember Gay Talese and Tom Wolfe in New York Magazine. One wonders, how does he know what people are thinking at the time? Well, you do detailed interviews. Now, Patricia has taken it to a power of 10 and gives us this marvelous detail of nonfiction so that, one, we believe it, and, two, she takes it to a depth which draws us in further. She's the queen.
Well, let's talk.
By the way, did I tell you all I'm a big fan of Bill?
Well, Patricia, let's talk for just a moment about what you write, because you're not just the author of the extremely popular Kay Scarpetta series, who also happens to be a female forensic pathologist. You also wrote one of the most famous recent books about true crime, which was
right.
Portrait of a Killer, Jack the Ripper, and Case Closed, in which you say you solved the Jack the Ripper mystery. And that caused a lot of controversy, and In Cold Blood caused a lot of controversy.
Well, the big difference is I didn't have the luxury of getting to talk to anybody who's still alive.
Certainly.
Obviously, since the Ripper cases mostly are identified as being around the 1888 period and a little bit later than that. So that would have made a big difference, you know, if I could have talked to people who could have helped me reconstruct what really occurred. And, you know, getting back to what Bill was talking about, where you're reading people's minds, I will say this for me, I'm very careful about doing that when I'm turning my hand to nonfiction. If I don't have reason to know what somebody was thinking or saying, i.e. through documents such as letters, I'm probably not going to go that far with that. I'm not going to criticize what Truman Capote did, however, because and he may have pulled all kinds of fast moves to get his information, but then he probably had to when you consider the people he was dealing with, particularly the people who were accused of the crime.
And you know, he was kind of inventing a genre there. That's Patricia Cornwell. She's America's best-selling crime author. We also spoke with Bill Curtis, investigative journalist and star of true crime documentaries In Cold Blood, 50 years old. That's in the headlines today.
So if you have reminiscences of In Cold Blood, how it affect your view of true crime, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org. Listen and react at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also talk about the possibility that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is going to get a trial in downtown Manhattan. Do you think it's appropriate or not? You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tomorrow, we're going to continue our week-long conversation with Stephen Dubner, co-author of Freakonomics. Global warming is on tap. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.